Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress that is trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. It's a great mattress at a very reasonable price point. Comes with a 20-year warranty and a great deal for our listeners. Douglas is giving you a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That is douglas.ca/CanadaLand. This episode is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health here in Toronto. Cutting-edge, state-of-the-art, compassionate facility. Right now, it is Mental Health Awareness Week. This is the time when they need you most. This is the time when you can make a real difference when it comes to doing something about the mental health crisis and the devastating opioid epidemic, the overdose epidemic that we're currently experiencing, losing 20 people every day. They need your help. Donate at camh.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. Jen Ag, restaurateur and author of I Hear She's a Real Bitch. Welcome back to Shortcuts, where we talk shit about the news.
Hey, Jesse.
Jen. The world of fine dining is in trouble. Celebrity chefs are losing their empires. Will we ever eat uni again? We're going to talk about a series of long reads on this disturbing trend.
I actually don't even love uni. Like, for luxury foods, it's not it for me.
Also, the saga of the New York Times caliphate debacle reaches its whimpering conclusion in an Ottawa courtroom. I was hoping that this would all just turn out to be like an elaborate Ali G movie gone wrong. And actually, the truth is not too far from that. Glad to have you back.
Thanks, pal.
This episode is brought to you by Dylan Cook, Christopher Griffiths, Sarah Fitzgerald, Adam Arscott, Rachel Elliott, Michael Schwant, Stephen Lalonde, and Aaron.
Hi, my name's Aaron. I live in Toronto, and I love to go for walks through the Don Valley. I love being kept company by Jesse and everybody at Canada Land. I've really enjoyed the White Saviors program because as somebody who's been in the nonprofit world for more than 10 years, there's a lot of interesting stuff going on there.
Jen, I keep reading these stories. This was like the lead story earlier this week in the Globe and Mail. Canada's high-end restaurants face struggle to survive. Prior to that, I read about celebrity chef Mark McEwen's troubles. His restaurant and gourmet foods business, his empire, files for creditor protection, citing a cash crunch. And not too long ago, there was this dishy piece that was going around in Toronto Life, inside the rise and fall of the Buca Empire. All very Toronto-centric, all very high-end dining-centric. I mean, you know, Toronto Life's going to be Toronto-centric, but the Globe stories, all of these stories about the difficulties that high-end restaurants and fine dining are encountering in this post-COVID universe, told from the perspective of celebrity chefs, restaurant empires, like even from the perspective of like investment firms. Quotes like, people at home don't necessarily want to order in a $70 tenderloin dinner. And when we talk about the labor side of this, the piece in Toronto Life actually did get into the labor stuff, though that wasn't really how it led. But, you know, they did look at it from the perspective of workers. But a lot of this stuff, like restaurant staff who were making $18 per hour pre-COVID can now demand $25 to $28, restaurant owners say. I feel like there are some assumptions about who we're supposed to relate to in these stories. I'm curious.
Is the question finally coming?
It's coming. As a titan of your own restaurant empire, how are you perceiving this like narrative about what's happening with restaurants? Like, what is the story here? Is the story that as you see it, that there's a big restaurant industry beyond a few like hoity-toity fine dining Toronto sure. spots. Like it's fun to read about these. We've been building up these rock star chefs or celebrity chefs, but there's another thing happening here that I'm a bit more concerned. I'm wondering what you think.
Well, first of all, I mean, I think just in terms of the Buca piece, it is filled with this sort of, I guess call it faux disgust at what is happening, which is hella ironic considering the writer's role in building up that restaurant and restaurants like that for more than a decade and being really a part of the problem that has put restaurants where they are now. And to sort of write this piece that's like condemning of all that with very little caveat around that is quite an eye roll for me. That's one perspective that I have. That's a very me-centric perspective, but that's why you had me on the show. But then, you know, to also really be focusing on like poor restaurant owners. As the restaurant owner, yes, things are bad if the subsidies, and I would consider my restaurants, I mean, I hate the sort of the term casual fine dining, but that's kind of what they are. And Grey Gardens may be a little more fine dining. So I understand the woes of these men, and they are mostly men. There's a labor shortage, and I know what people say when the word labor shortage is ever spoken by any boss. It's actually not a labor shortage. It's a good work shortage. And that's totally fair and reasonable, especially when it comes to the restaurant business. So, I think in as much as there's been a kind of reckoning about the actual working conditions in restaurants, the way people are exploited or abused or any, you know, we all sort of know what's happening right now. I don't know that there's been any real change. And I think that that is causing people to leave the industry in droves. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I really feel sorry for like the Mark McEwens and the high-end steakhouse owners of the city. Like they've had a good run. They're in their 60s. Retire, bitch.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking you'd say. I don't feel too differently. What we're seeing, I think, is like something that's been going on for a long time. I had this one dinner party experience with Mark McEwen, celebrity chef, media personality, Top Chef Canada dude. And, you know, it was back when our mutual acquaintance, Corey Mintz, was hosting dinner parties for his old column. And Mark McEwen was there. And he was like just basically there to cheerlead for Doug Ford's plan at the time.
Oh, that does not surprise me.
Yeah, like Doug Ford wanted to open like a casino in Ontario Place and have a Ferris wheel. And people were like, Toronto is like paralyzed with construction and traffic. Why would you open a casino right at the epicenter of downtown Toronto? And McEwen was there like, oh, I think it's a great idea.
Oh, is he going to get the restaurant contract for that?
Yeah, he was there because like, this was a guy who had made a name for himself and was like a Canadian answer to certain American celebrity chefs. And people were lining up to put millions of dollars into his restaurants. And that was like, he would follow the money and open up a big fine dining place anywhere that somebody else was willing to pay for it. And I can't give you full credit for this, Jen, but it seems like something started in food somewhere in the 2008 or so, 2009, like, and your friend Tony Bourdain with this whole rock star chef thing and like really like, let's strip away all of the fancy bougie stuff and let's get like just good food in like a rock and roll atmosphere and let's have an open kitchen and really like, you know, vibe with the behind the scenes, like hard living, hard drinking. Like it started there and then it just got like everything glossed up and glitzed up and pumped up. And, you know,
ruined.
We were referring. Yeah. I mean, you know, Chris Nettlesmith, who wrote the Buca piece, which I thought was a terrific and well-investigated piece, but you bring up a valid point.
I thought so too, by the way, despite my eye roll about it.
And I think you have maybe a conflict in that there's, you know, Chris Nettlesmith wrote some stuff about one of your joints and there's bad blood from.
No, not at all.
Okay.
No.
I just want to get it all out there for our listeners. But anyhow, he was absolutely, and he owns this in the piece, he was building up Buca. And, you know, Buca was pretty good. But, like, he was building up, like, this empire, which was, like, kind of this crazy story of taking out like these like mafia style loans and leaving mushroom purveyors and different people, you know, holding the bag, millions and millions of dollars in debt.
But everyone, by the way, Jesse, everyone knew about this for years and years and years and years. This was not news to anyone working in the industry.
That Buka was just digging this massive, massive grave for itself.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that they were hugely, hugely exploitative of their workers and borderline abusive.
So here we are now, and it's fun to watch. Like, it's a game that we play. It's like this Vanity Fair thing of like, oh, we've built up these huge glossy brands. Now let's watch them all crumble. And I just wonder if like the coverage is like, wait, but like it was never sustainable. And it was only almost like a cult where you could get people to work for these ridiculous wages. It feels like we're playing a game of like we inflated a balloon. The media like inflated a big balloon of big money food. And now we're having fun popping the balloon. And it's dishy and fun to read those stories. But maybe we're missing the point of what's actually happening.
Well, I mean, it's hard for me to, I think, be that objective about this because I've been talking about it for so long. And I've been so vilified for talking about these kinds of bad actors and bad restaurants for so long and alienated in the industry for daring to sort of say anything about it. And so now when it feels like, for lack of a better way to put it, people are starting to catch up to that, I don't know that they're also thinking, oh yeah, here's this person in our city who has been talking about this. They're thinking that they've just sort of discovered it. And that can be very frustrating. So I can't speak to it that objectively, but I can say that I don't think it's a bad thing that a company like Buka gets a takedown like that, even if it's sort of maliciously gross the way that everybody eats it up. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And what do you think about like another celebrity chef who was in the Globe piece, Vikram Vij, saying profit margins are razor thin. You're lucky if you, you know, like have a 5% profit margin at the end of the day. So we can all talk about how we need to raise the wages, but that just makes the whole enterprise impossible and we won't have restaurants anymore. That's basically the economic argument.
I don't think that's true. I mean, first of all, you need to raise the price of food to raise the wages. Like, that's obvious. And I think that's something that diners sometimes don't want to grasp. But at the same time, restaurants have survived so much. And they're going to survive this too. And there's always going to be rich people going to fine dining restaurants. I don't think that they're in the sort of perilous place that they claim to be in. And I don't, again, I'm not saying that this has been awful for everyone. Obviously, I understand that. And I think fine dining, one of the takeaways from that piece for me was how fine dining doesn't really translate to takeout. But I also think that you can be innovative about it and you can be like, fuck, you know what? We're fine dining. We're not going to be sending people home with a 12-course, tiny little plates meal, but maybe we can make the best burger on earth or, you know, we can figure out a thing. And I think that the restaurants that sort of are able to do things like that and roll with the punches are going to be fine. You know, we're pretty much at the tail end of this, so my feeling is if you've made it this far, you're going to make it through, with the exception that there are maybe some back taxes you might owe.
I wonder if this like incessant focus on the very, very high end and the celebrity end of and fine dining itself is not like a weird red herring. The bigger question is, can like the entire rest of the restaurant industry come out the other side of this? And will people still work in restaurants? And do the economics of restaurants still make sense? Which we're seeing a lot less focus in the media on that story.
Yeah, I know. It's really awful. Like the stuff, I don't want to make it any, you know, less Toronto-centric, but the stuff about, say, 11 Madison Park going vegetarian, it's just like, get out of here. Are you guys serious? There are so many other stories to focus on aside from these very rich people backed by literal, like, hedge funds. Like, these are hedge fund restaurants. For me, they're not the lifeblood of the industry. I mean, I understand how it works. And I understand that things that happen in high-end restaurants often trickle down, you know, like the best way to, a good example is more than a decade ago with Pork Belly and seeing something like that happen where all of a sudden like Milestones is selling Pork Belly. And, you know, that's how that happened. And everybody becomes more aware of the food trends that are infiltrating at first sort of this very limited sphere where not a lot of people have access. So yeah, those restaurants are going to be fine. There's going to be people that continue to pump money into them, but the rest of the industry definitely could use some media attention that it is not getting. And that's partly because we don't have food media in Toronto. Like, I'm not sure if you're aware of that, but there just isn't a food media anymore. Not really.
There's no restaurant critics. There are influencers and Instagrammers.
What? That's not even a thing.
Well, we have food influencers. We have Food Instagram, which has sort of taken the place of restaurant critics in terms of telling people, here's the next thing you need to eat.
And you'd think that that would be more democratic, but I don't think that it is.
I remember you not being so hot on restaurant reviewers, and now they're dead. They're gone. And now what they're replaced with first was Yelp, and now it's Instagram. It ain't much better.
Yeah, see, that's not fair. As much as I might get annoyed by, say, having a review of my personality instead of a review of my restaurant, which I believe is a pretty reasonable thing to be annoyed by, it doesn't mean that I don't have respect for people who are good at it or respect the art of criticism. I absolutely do. And it sucks that we don't have good critics to support the industry now.
Yeah. You know, you bring up Pork Belly. I'm kind of glad you did because I've been thinking about this. You first entered the scene during a collapse of fine dining. That kind of was what precipitated the food trend and the restaurant trend that you brought into this country, which had to do with like all of these really well-trained chefs were kind of like loose because there weren't as many jobs at fine dining places in 2008 after the recession. And this innovation of like, let's go to a part of town where leases are cheap. Let's turn a bar into a restaurant. Let's take fine cooking techniques and style and use off cuts, cheap things that other people don't want. And remember where cooking comes from. And then we see this cycle where that just like the prices went up and the celebrities got inflated and now it's collapsed again. Is this just not like the cycle playing itself out again?
Sure. I mean, I think that's something to be very aware of, too, is that things become really hot for a minute and then they become mainstream and they fade. And that cycle seems to, you know, increase or has obviously gotten faster and faster the more that we are connected over social media. Like it used to take a little bit longer for the hot band in Melody Maker to trickle down to the mainstream in some ways. But I also think that we're starting to see a little bit of an off-cut revival right now, which I'm sure has something to do with economy, even though it's not cheap anymore. Like, I'm definitely seeing it. I'm seeing sweetbreads. I haven't seen sweetbreads in, you know, 5-6 years on a lot of menus. And I think that we're going to start to see that a little bit because we've been very veg focused for what, let's say 5 years. We've been very focused on lighter food, vegetables, highlighting that. And I don't think that's going to go away. And the same way that I think something like charcuterie or bread programs just became part, they just became part of regular good restaurant menus. They just became part of what a restaurant was selling. So now it's not like a place is necessarily like focusing so much on charcuterie, but they, if they're a good restaurant, maybe they have their own little charcuterie program. So I think that's what kind of happens with the good parts of things that get hot is they just become part of it.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's amazing the things that we tell ourselves to talk ourselves out of getting help. Anybody who's actually gotten help knows that the process of getting things off your chest, of taking your stressors, your problems, and just like not letting them be bottled up, working through just conveying them to somebody, half of the battle is just doing that. You unburden yourself. And you know what? If you have a real mental health professional, no, they don't have magic bullets or magic words that make it all go away. But often they can help you see things a little bit differently and guide you to strategies or tools or to a new perspective that actually does help. As the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Because you listen to this podcast, you get 10% off of your first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp, therapy online that has served over 3 million people around the world, and it's available here in Canada. And this time of year, we're all emerging from our winter like seclusion and, patio season and socializing, and it can be terrifically fun, but it can also create a lot of pressure. And some people get like anxiety, social anxiety from being out too much. What did Iggy Pop say about social life? It's torture dressed as fun. It doesn't need to be torture. I think it's just about finding like the right balance of how much of other people do you want? I mean, we need each other, but I think that at a certain point, it can become overwhelming. And talking to somebody about yourself, about your social life, about your relationships is a way of gaining insight into what is right for you. It's not selfish to examine that with a professional. And as the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Listeners of the show get 10% off of their first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's better, H-E-L-P, betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. Jen Ag, my buddy, we like to duly note things on this show when there's something that more people should know about. You know, it's a service that we provide. Can I share something with you, Jen?
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you caught this piece in the Globe. KGB archives show how Chrystia Freeland drew the ire and respect of Soviet intelligence services. This story kind of comes out of nowhere about how, like, secret files have been revealed, and it portrays our now Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland as this, like, globe-trotting spy hero. It's a fascinating story. The infamous KGB praised Chrystia Freeland's savvy, even as she frustrated their attempts to spy on her in Cold War Ukraine. They tagged her with a codename Frida. But today we know Chrystia Freeland as our deputy prime minister. I enjoyed reading this thing, but I'm just like, why is this here? I mean, it was written by this guy, Simon Miles, assistant professor in the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. Like, where did this come from? And then Tom Mulcair, former NDP leader Tom Mulcair, writing in CTV, writes, a breathless account of Chrystia Freeland's heroics in Ukraine, published over the weekend, must have put a smile on the face of our deputy prime minister. Let's face it, she's positioning herself to take over as leader of the Liberal Party of Canada, and this type of publicity is tailor-made to help her achieve that ambition. And that made a certain sense to me. Like, it really did feel like this was like, we're kind of just being subjected to this like information campaign that leads to an inevitability that Chrystia Freeland is the new leader of the Liberal Party and then the Prime Minister of Canada. And I'm just like, I don't know the backstory as to what the Globe's role in this is, if this got fed to them, if they were like, yes, we too have an editorial agenda of getting rid of Trudeau and installing Chrystia Freeland, or if this was just like, hey, great story, let's publish it, and somebody else is managing some larger PR campaign. But it did really feel like there was some kind of political machination behind the scenes. And maybe, like, as Mulcair suggests, we're all supposed to just be like, yep, that's how it's done. And what I'm duly noting, not the piece, which was very popular and not something that went under the radar, but like this thing that often happens in Canadian media, especially with the Globe and Mail, where you really get a strong sense that levers are being pulled and we're supposed to be led down a certain path to think of things in a certain way to lead to some other move that someone's contemplating. And it doesn't sit well with me and it doesn't feel transparent or forthcoming to me.
But isn't that what media is? I mean, I've personally experienced so much of that of course I believe that that's what is happening in the media often.
Obviously, that's what, you know, PR agents exist. Like, people try to manipulate the media to achieve a certain goal. I just feel like the Globe at times is acting as a representative of its reader, telling you what's going on. And at other times, it feels like they're kind of playing their cards close to their chest. And whether they're kind of in on it or not, or what happened or why it happened, we're left in the dark about. And it's sort of just this organ of the powers that be in a way that I find kind of incompatible with the idea that the press represents the public. You know what I mean?
I do, but I don't think you're ever going to fully know, because whenever those conversations are happening, they're happening like with two people behind closed doors and not over text message if they're smart.
Yeah, it's just that I would hope that one of those people isn't in the newspaper business, but maybe that's naive of me.
Come on. That's duly noted, Jesse.
Jen, I know that you've put a tremendous amount of time into your duly noted today. What do you have for us?
I was very clear with your producer that I had nothing for you because I am trying to relax on a mini vacation. I am out of town for 3 days and I agreed to do this out of my deep devotion to you, my friend. So I guess I could say that my duly noted is, if you can escape the city
for a couple of days and watch the leaves turn over rolling hills, then you should really do that.
Vacations are good. Duly noted. I have one more. This is something that I think deserves wider attention. CBC reported that there is a state of emergency in Iqaluit. There's fuel in the tap water.
Sorry, what?
There is fuel in the tap water. You can't boil it out. There's fuel. It's poisoned.
Good Lord.
And people are flocking to the nearby Sylvia Grinnell River to gather drinking water, which is going to freeze over very soon. And there is no other water source. There's a run on bottled water, and who in Iqaluit can go and like buy all the bottled water and who can't? And what the hell is going to happen in Iqaluit if there's no drinking water is maybe a news story deserving of wider attention.
Duly noted.
Jen, can I pitch you a podcast idea?
Okay, what's the troll here?
No, it's a story. This is just like, I think this would make okay. This would make a great story. Like, listen, okay, so here's the plot. This is the elevator pitch here. 20-something slacker guy from Burlington lives with his parents, spends a lot of time on the internet, starts making shit up online that actually he's a soldier in an elite international brigade. And his bullshit is taken seriously by various researchers, and they make reports of threats, and his name gets on the list. And then that list gets into the hands of a rising star reporter for the New York Times, who tracks the guy down in Burlington and interviews him. And he just feeds her like a crazy bullshit story. And she falls for it hook, line, and sinker, and even eggs him on to take it a little bit further. You need to talk about the killings, she urges him. And the guy goes, oh, yeah, sure, killings. Like, I totally did killings. Let me think back on all those killings I did.
The blood was just, it was warm. And it sprayed everywhere. And the guy cried, was crying and screaming. He did not die after the first time. The second time or so, he probably just flunched over. That was...
How hard is it to put a knife into somebody?
It's hard. I had to stab him multiple times. So, and then... we put him up on a cross, and I had to leave the dagger in his heart.
She turns these interviews into a prestige podcast all about this guy's evil deeds fighting for ISIS in Syria.
Oh, shit. That's crazy.
Okay? And she makes this podcast, and it's rolled out on The Daily, which is like millions of people listen to this, and it's like, mwah, this is like boutique prestige podcasting. This is journalism of the highest order. It gets nominated for a Pulitzer. It wins the Peabody Award. Meanwhile, as a result of this, like, this is embarrassing for Canada. The New York Times is reporting that we've got a real live murdering terrorist walking the streets of Burlington, and conservative MPs lambast the Trudeau government, and the conservative press has a field day. Why do they have to find out from the New York Times that a terrorist murderer is just walking the streets free in Canada? What does Justin Trudeau have to say for himself about this? And here we'll hear Member of Parliament Candace Bergen.
Canadians deserve more answers from this government.
Absolutely.
Why aren't they doing something about this despicable animal walking around the country?
And then Candace Malcolm, another Candace, writing in, yes, Post Media, The Sun. Imagine the incompetence of the Trudeau government letting an admitted ISIS murderer live freely in Canada and on top of it receive a taxpayer-subsidized education at a Canadian university. What's next for him? A $10 million check? And so it's embarrassing the government, and so law enforcement springs into action and they come find the guy, but they can't make a case. They can't even find evidence that he's ever left Canada for Syria. So instead, Jen, they charge him with something else. They charge him with pretending to be a terrorist, perpetrating a hoax. So now the guy is in a particular bind. The cops are like, admit it, you're guilty. Admit that you're not a terrorist. I'm innocent. I'm actually a terrorist. Well, that's actually much worse. Okay, I'm innocent. I made it all up. Okay, good. We've established that you're guilty. You can go home to Burlington now. Go home to your parents. That is what happened. That is what happened with Shiroz Chaudhry.
That is truly bananas. I have one question. I mean, I have a lot of questions. Why did he do this? Like, the why has not been answered for me.
Why does some trifling guy who lives with his parents lie on the internet and act like he's some international big shot killer? You don't know why?
Yeah, it's a bit nuts.
Why do dudes lie about lots of things on the internet? I don't know.
Okay, it's not like this is not lots of things. This is beyond lots of things. Like, this is pretty, it's a pretty fucked up lie to tell.
I've maintained for a long time that if you have a lot of people dressing up as Batman, someone's going to dress up as the Joker. So law enforcement is on this constant 24/7 terrorist watch, and there's people surveying the internet and looking for terrorists, and we've turned the ISIS fighter into, this is like the biggest boogeyman. So that imbues a lot of power and juice into the persona of the ISIS killer. And I think it's just a matter of time before someone puts up their hand and says, me, I'm the killer, I'm the terrorist, because that's super badass. I think that basically the anti-terrorist surveillance state creates these figures.
Yeah, okay, all right.
Anyhow, it's a wild debacle. The New York Times has yet to actually retract Caliphate in full. It's over. It's collapsed. He was never in Syria. It was all bullshit. It was bullshit from the New York Times.
Wow. How did that stuff get past fact-checking? I don't understand. Like, you would think that there'd be people looking into the truth of what this person said.
I mean, that is an excellent question. And the Times, as much as they've said anything, they've said that, like, their normal processes didn't work here because it was podcasting and they didn't have the same filters. And now, as a result, they've got, like, better filters and they've got, you know, excellent fact-checking for their podcasts as well. And, like, certainly, I think that's kind of a bullshit excuse, but I do feel like the fact that they turned this into this big, epic, cinematic thing, I think did cloud their judgment. I don't think you can blame it on podcasting, but I think the Times fell in love with this kind of, like, you know, if telling this in print wouldn't have had the same impact and it wouldn't have had the same audience. And Rukmini Kalamachi, the reporter behind this, I think was able to get away with stuff that other reporters wouldn't have because of the way she was telling it and because the stuff was so new.
Huh. Well, it's a pretty wild ride.
Crazy shit. That's your cuts. Jen Ag, thank you.
No, thank you.
We're on Twitter at CanadaLand. I can be emailed. I'm at jesse@CanadaLand.com. I read everything that you send. Jen, where can people find you?
Twitter. I'm on Twitter @TheBlackHoof. And I'm on Instagram with something else. Just my name with some underscores.
Hey, Jen, mining is like a big fucking deal in Canada, bigger than you might think. And the stories from the world of mining are jaw-dropping. And our show Commons just launched their new season all about stories from the world of Canadian mining. Go listen to that podcast. It's awesome.
I'm actually in the middle of listening to another podcast. It's called The White Saviors. It's pretty good.
Aw, you're listening to the show.
I am. It's great. I really like it.
Thank you. This episode is produced by Tiffany Lamb with additional production by Tristan Capicchione. Our managing editor is Kieran Oudshorn. Theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV, 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. If you like what we do and you want to support what we do, go to canadaland.com/join and we'll give you ad-free podcasts and other stuff, and we do need your support. Go to canadaland.com/join.